chapter 3 of the book of Job. After this, opened Job his mouth and cursed this day, and Job spake and said, "Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, there is a man child conceived." Now, look at verse 14, verse 11. "Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the goat when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent me, or why the breast that I should suck?" And so on. Now then, he wants to die, as you'll see. Now look down, please. When he thinks of death, there the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary be at rest. Now look at verse 25. "For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me." And that's his first address. And then now Eliphaz speaks in chapter 4. And he says, verse 2, "If we essay to commune with thee, wilt thou be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Behold, thou hast instructed many, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upholden him that was falling, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees. But now it has come upon thee, and thou faintest. It toucheth thee, and thou art troubled." Now, then you see, he sees this wonderful vision here in verse 13. "The thoughts from the vision of the night when deep sleep falleth on men." Then verse 17, "Shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker?" And look at verse 20. "They are destroyed from morning to evening. They perish forever without any regarding it. Doth not their excellency which is in them go away? They die even without wisdom." Now, that is continued into chapter 5 and verse 3. "I have seen the foolish taken root, but suddenly I cursed his habitation. His children are far from safety, and they are crushed in the gate. Neither is there any to deliver them. Whose harvest the hungry eateth up, and taketh it even out of the thorns, and the robber swalloweth up their substance." And then in verse 14, "They meet with darkness in the daytime, and grope in the noonday and at the night." And then you have Job again answering in chapter 6, "Oh, that my grief were truly wed." And goes on speaking, and then we have Bildad having a word in chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 8. "For inquire, I pray thee, of former age, and prepare thyself to search of the fathers, for we are but of yesterday," and so on. Now here, verse 11, "Can the rush grow up without mire? Can the flag grow without water?" And then we get the other man having a word. Job answers that, but then in verse chapter 11, now we're not going to read these things in detail. Chapter 11, we have Zophar giving his word. And look at verse 17. "Thine age shall be clearer than the noonday." This is what will happen if he repents. "And shall shine forth, there shall be as the morning." Now verse 20. "But the eyes of the wicked shall fail, and they shall not escape, and their hope shall be as the giving up of the ghost." Then you have Job's answer here. "No doubt, but ye are the people, and wisdom shall die with you." And that will do for reading. As you would know, no one taking up the book of Job would be capable in 5 minutes to go through the book in detail. But we do want now, just in as some humble a way as we can, take a look at these wiseacres that had to do with Job, their speeches. You know, it was a marvelous thing to see four men with the minds and understanding that these men possessed, all gathered together. And it must have been a marvelous experience for Elihu to sit and listen to them. It was great to listen to people with really developed minds. and expressing themselves in figurative language and in poetic language. Not many of us could express ourselves poetically as they did, and they must have been the most intelligent people on the face of the earth at that particular time. And there they are, all grouped together. I think you will agree that Job was no fool by any means. He was quite an intelligent man as well as a wealthy man. And you will agree that his three friends were likewise very intelligent men, because when they're speaking, they certainly show and disclose much that they knew and understood. Now, you'll notice that the meeting was very slow at getting started. 7 days, they said, and nobody spoke. Nobody spoke. They were slow at getting started. And evidently, everybody's mind was been churned up, you know, and getting ready for what they would say. And they were slow at making a move, but when they did make a move, of course, they had plenty to say. And Job himself certainly showed his ability in speaking as he did. Now, when we think of this, Job was the first to speak. And he has two major thoughts in his first speech at the start of it. One was this: it would have been a mercy. He had never been born. And it had been a mercy if even when he was born, he had just been smothered and died and never knew anything in this world. Now, as he looks back on that, he can say, well, that certainly would have saved me any trouble. Any trouble. You know, sometimes now, without going too far, you will agree, maybe many a dear sinner concerned about salvation has come to the place in his thinking when he just wished he had never been born. And some of us did that. Now, we're not pushing it too far when we say that. We just felt, now here I am, I'm alive, I can't escape eternity, I'm going to have to go into eternity, and I'm not going to be saved, and I don't know that I'll ever be saved, I haven't a hope of being saved, everything's black and dark. I hope you know what I'm talking about, at least this is my way of thinking before I was saved. And then to think, well, if I don't get saved, wasn't it a pity I was ever born? That's why Job spends quite a bit of his time cursing his day, saying, now, this should be known as the black day in history, the day Job was born, because it brought into the world a man that's having trouble and sorrow, deep and serious grief, and has passed through the millstone in the millstones of trial in a way very few had endured. Now, the second great thought he has in his mind, now, he's not by any means right in this, but he's thinking and he's working and he's talking. And it's this: if I can't escape life because I'm already in it, and I didn't die as an infant on my mother's knee, or before I was really nursed at all, and I didn't get out of the world before I knew anything that was going on in the world, the next best thing for me is for God to take me out of it. And now he's getting to the place where he just wants to die. Wants to die. Now that's a very serious thing, because many a time that does come in the way of people in trial. There's many a creature lying in hospital, and they're just waiting for the day when the Lord will take them home. Because they know that the weary are at rest. They know it's an end of their troubles. And Job feels, well now, if the Lord would only take me away, sure that would be it all. Why doesn't he close his hand on my breath? Why doesn't he finish with me and I'm done with me and give me over? Let me alone and let me lie down and have finished with all these trials and problems. Now that again is a very weighty matter in the minds of the Lord's people. I visited a man you all nearly know, very well known here, and he says, I've learned a lesson. Maybe I never heard them pressed as well. He says, you know, I read the Believer, I believe the magazine sometimes, and I read about so-and-so went home to be with the Lord. And I read another magazine, so-and-so went home to be with the Lord. He says, you know what I'm going to tell you? There's nobody goes home to be with the Lord. And I looked at him, the way you're looking at me. He says they have to wait till they're taken home. For you see, I've been wanting to die now for weeks, and the man's not dead yet. I've been trying to die for weeks, he says, and I can't get down at all. He says, I just can't die. I just wanted to die, but I couldn't. I just wanted to die, but I couldn't do it. You see, I'm going to have to wait, and he'll still have to wait. He's still waiting. If you want his address, I could maybe slip it to you, but he's still waiting. He hasn't got away yet. I hope we learn that. That many a time our minds would work in such a way we just wish we were out of all these problems, wouldn't we? Finished with preaching and finished with Christians and finished with troubles and finished with home problems and finished with every difficulty. Finished with limitations in our bodies and limitations in our memories. And I don't know whether you get angry with yourself or not, but some of us feel at times just we feel as if we would just wish we had finished with the whole thing and would make no more mistakes. You don't know what it's like. Says somebody, yes, always making mistakes. As long as we're here, we'll likely have causes for discouragement and causes for distress and so on. Now, says Job, God, you didn't take me away as an infant, but you could do something now for me. Not as you could take me away now, and I finish with me. Well, another point comes up in that first sermon, that first address that he gave. I don't go into details, you know, and it's this, that he discloses in it, that in his mind, prior to the trials that came his way, there was a secret fear that they would come. Now listen to these words. The thing which I greatly feared has come upon me. Now there could have been in his mind, right along in the days of his prosperity, that there could come a time when things would change. And that's what he feared. He feared it coming his way. He could see that there are flocks and herds and there's, you know, the big thing we spoke about, the great stock that he had and the wonderful prosperity he had. And the thought was in his mind, now, that could be left, taken away from me. And now the thing that he feared most, it's gone. It's gone. Now, this is a very important side of life that all you younger Christians should remember. That one thing God wants you to learn as best you can in your early Christian life, and that is that you have no fears or dreads of changing circumstances. Now, you mightn't like that. But you see, life is solemn, and it's only once we're here. But God would have us to be so confident in our trust in Him, that we really can sing what we do sing, maybe without much thought, that the worst that can come but shortens the journey and hastens my home. And that the things that people would dread and fear, some would live in dread of unemployment, and some would live in dread of poor health. Mind you, it's no joke, health breaking down. It's terrible. It's terrible. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not here to make you miserable or anything like that. But it's an awful blow in a man in the midst of health just to discover that I'm not well and I'll never be well again and I'll never be the same again. That's a big trial. Big trial. Many a man fears it. Many a man fears the day when he'll not be able to do the things he's doing now and he can't carry the burdens that he's carrying now and he would fear those things. The thing that I greatly feared has come upon me. I sat in a home. Now, not many of you have been in it, I think. I don't think anybody here has been in it, but we're in New Zealand. And it was in the home of an Irish man and his wife in New Zealand. And we were sitting talking in a fairly general way just at the meal. And one thing that I could notice, it was very obvious, that they had been through the awful times of distress in New Zealand. In those difficult days after the First World War. We call them here the Hungry 30s. I don't know whether you know what that means or not. Some of you were through them. And we had hard times in Northern Ireland. It was very difficult when I was being reared. And then they called it the Depression. And you know, every time nearly they would start to talk about things, they'd say, you know, we always fear lest another Depression would come. Another Depression would come. It'd be an awful thing if a depression would come. You could hardly save up enough or hardly have enough gathered together in case this depression would come. And in case this difficulty would come. In the mercy of God, it hasn't come, and I think one of them's away home to heaven, so they haven't faced any depression. They have got an uplift instead of a down cast. But at the same time, you see how certain things get into people's minds, and they begin to fear. Now he says, the thing that I greatly feared has come upon me. God brought him into the very circumstances that he dreaded, but that is to show him that he can undertake for him in those circumstances, and that he had no need to fear them. That, I judge, is a very important lesson to learn. That we have nothing to fear, for God would want to remove every vestige of it from us. For alongside fear, there is a sprinkling of unbelief. For unbelief and fear must be close cousins. Now we come to what is maybe uppermost in most of your minds, and that is, how would these three friends, how would they act in the presence of a man like Job? Now, apparently, the Eliphaz man was the eldest of the three. And evidently the most refined and the most cautious in what he said. And he's going to have a speech, and he's going to say something to Job. And when he's finished, of course, Job will answer extensively and give him his answer, as we would say. And then after he has finished, then this Bildad man, he comes on the scene and he speaks. And when he has spoken, Job again gives an extensive answer. And then the other man, the Zophar man, the Zophar man, he comes along and he makes his speech, a very short one, and Job answers him. Now, in case some of the younger Christians don't know, each of these men speaks three times. But Zophar only gets two goes at it. Apparently, when it came to near the end, he felt there was nothing he could say that would add to the others. Now, they don't all argue on the same lines. But we do want us to see, as best we can, how they were all aiming at one big point. And that is this. Now listen carefully. Here's the confusion that was in their mind. They can't understand how a righteous God and a good God could allow one of his choice children, or we would call it in our day, or one of his chosen ones, allow him to suffer and come through the privations that Job had passed through. Now, they just can't understand that. They come to this conclusion, very thoughtfully come to it now. They did it very logically and very thoughtfully. Job, if God has treated you as we see he has, he's such a righteous God that if you were a righteous man, he wouldn't allow that to happen. So therefore, the only conclusion we can come to is this, that the righteous never perish, and the righteous are never in affliction the way you are. Therefore, there must be sin in your life that we know nothing about. But God knows about it, and that's why he's dealing with you as he is. Now, this is all very solemn, because here's a man down. Now, in the world, they'll tell you, don't kick a man when he's down. But when he's down, his friends are putting him further down. They're putting him further down. And they're telling him, indeed, I think it was that last man that told them, or maybe Bildad, I'm not too sure, can a rush grow without mire? There must be mire about you somewhere, Job. We see the rushes, we don't see the mire, but we can see the rushes. They're growing up. And this is why you're suffering. And this is why God has punished you. And then they're telling him, in another way, Job, the answer to your problem is this. You turn away from your iniquity. Turn away from your evil deeds. Turn away from your bad living. Turn away from your cruelties. Turn away from your misbehavior. And God will again bless you and make you a blessing. Now that sounds very logical, doesn't it? That's men thinking along their lines. Now, when Eliphaz is looking for his information, or for the basis for his thinking is, He thinks of what he sees. In fact, in this very chapter, in chapter 4, he tells us about a wonderful vision that went across his eyes, and how he saw this thing, and it made the very hair of his head stand on, and how it was sort of so enlightening to his mind, and so on. And this was just the very thing that Job would need to learn. Ah, yes. Now you listen carefully, dear friend, and you'll see that they were not even using the knowledge that they had, because they said they never saw the righteous perish. What about Abel? Didn't he perish? Wasn't he righteous? And yet they're saying we never saw the righteous perish. Sure, the very opening story. You say, but they have no Bible. No, but they're bound to have this handed down to them. And they're bound to have had it left on record, the events of the early days of the creation. They're certainly not ignorant of that. And you see, at the very threshold of your Bible, now get a hold of a child of God. You'll never be right until you do. On the very threshold of your Bible, the righteous man is put to death by his wicked brother. What's that? God giving us the headline. The very start of our Bible. And you come right on through to the New Testament and you find the righteous, perfect Son of God, and he's nailed upon a cross. Do you see the world hadn't changed much? Sure it hadn't. The shepherd in Genesis chapter 4 was murdered by his brother, and the good shepherd of the gospel is murdered by man, the righteous suffering. And that staggers the world right away. In other words, God, just as it were, would cut the very foundation from these men's theories right at the very threshold of his word. And it had been honest men that would have said, well, now, we mustn't be too quick, because sometimes God allows the righteous to suffer and allows the wicked to prosper. And that, again, is a problem that the worldlings can't understand. Yes. One of the heaviest blows that hit on Job. Now, mind you, sometimes there are daggers go in and you feel them, and sometimes there's a painful dagger. Mind you, it's a sore one. They were telling Job, look, Job, you're not only suffering yourself, but the reason why your family perished was because of your sin. And because of the way you have lived and the way they lived, they have been cut off. And that's why you have them all lost today. That's why you've lost them. Now you just try to think of the man scraping himself now with a piece of delf, sitting on ashes in the deepest distress that a man could be in, and then somebody rubbing salt into his wounds. You know what that means? Agitating him by grieving his very soul and saying, man, you not only have ruined yourself, but you've ruined your family. I mean, that's a hard nut, wasn't it? Be honest about it. Sometimes we can bear the people, you know, giving us ourselves a fair crack. There's many a mother, you know, and she wouldn't mind you giving her a bit of a snub. But she doesn't like to see you hurting the child. Doesn't like you seeing her fair to the children, you know. He touched them, it's a wee bit different. She doesn't like that. And you see, Job was getting it driven home to him by these men. Look, you not only have ruined yourself, but you've ruined your family. And that's the secret sin that's behind you now. No, well, that, of course, Job couldn't swallow. Now, I know that you men have read it and you've preached it maybe till you're quite confident in your mind that the whole way to preach Job is that he's a self-righteous man and he had to be taught his sinfulness, and until he discovered his true condition and repented in dust and ashes, then he was not right with God. Now, that's your way of looking at it. And you preach it in the gospel. How can man be just with God? And you take the different verses up and you use them in that way. That's all right. We leave you to do that. But you must be very honest when you're dealing with the book of Job. When those men were talking about Job's sin and Job's life and Job's behavior, they were thinking of gross sin that was on his life. That was so sinful that God's judgment would have to be executed upon it. And Job knew there was nothing in his life in that way. And that didn't mean that Job believed that he was sinless before God. He didn't do that. But as far as men observing him was concerned, and as far as his behavior was concerned, he knew nothing of what they were charging him for. Now that's where they were grieving God, and that's where they were sinning in what they were insinuating. They were entirely misunderstanding Job's condition. When it comes to Elihu, the second man, Bildad, he has a different basis for reasoning. And he says, now, my way of arguing, Job, is this, you ask the old people, and you inquire. In other words, it's what he'll hear that decides his arguments. And you ask the old people, and they all tell you the same thing, that wherever there's wickedness, God's judgment falls, and where there's righteousness, God's blessing comes. And that's the solution to him, as far as he's concerned. Job, the sooner you repent, the better. And the sooner you change your way of living, the better. And the sooner you do what's right, the sooner blessing will come your way. It's reckoned, I'm not too good a judge, because you know I would know very little about original languages, but it's reckoned that the Zophar man, who comes in at the end, that he is the more blunt man of the three. Perhaps the first man would be what we would call a little more refined. You know, even though he was driving home the wrong ideas, he was refined in the doing of it. And the second man maybe not just as refined, and the third man more crude, something like an Irishman, I suppose, toward the end. He was just blunt and plain at what he had to say. And he, again, gets to the same point. Now listen to it, each one of them agreeing, absolutely united, agreeing on one fact. Now look, Joe, your trouble lies in the fact that there was secret sin in your life. We only saw the rushes, but there was more below them. We only saw the outward, but there was something going on behind the scenes. And they're insinuating, and they're implying, and at times even stating, look, Job, you're just suffering for your iniquities, and you're just suffering for your evils. And Job knew before God that that was not right. Now, as to how to answer these men is the problem. How did Job... Now, I think we said the other night here, and we repeat it. We don't think we're dead stupid because we go over a thing twice. We repeat it. Job's friends brought the worst out of Job, for they agitated him. And please, do your utmost, brethren and sisters, not to take the worst out of people. Now, try your best not to work it. There are some experts that just raising everybody's back, you know, something like an Irishman, I suppose, toward the end. He was just blunt and plain at what he had to say. And he, again, gets to the same point. Now listen to it, each one of them agreeing, absolutely united, agreeing on one fact. Now look, Joe, your trouble lies in the fact that there was secret sin in your life. We only saw the rushes, but there was more below them. We only saw the outward, but there was something going on behind the scenes. And they're insinuating, and they're implying, and at times even stating, look, Job, you're just suffering for your iniquities, and you're just suffering for your evils. And Job knew before God that that was not right. Now, as to how to answer these men is the problem. How did Job... Now, I think we said the other night here, and we repeat it. We don't think we're dead stupid because we go over a thing twice. We repeat it. Job's friends brought the worst out of Job, for they agitated him. And please, do your utmost, brethren and sisters, not to take the worst out of people. Now, try your best not to work it. There are some experts that just raising everybody's back. You know, they get everybody's back up. They can always make a man angry if they can do nothing else. And they think that's great. When that was what Job's friends did with him, they upset him and they annoyed him. And they made him say things that possibly he'd have been better not say, and I think we'll all agree to that. For he put his hand in his mouth at the finish and felt that was he might very well have just let them carry on with their arguments and not bother trying to answer them. All he was trying to say is this. Now you men are blaming me in the wrong. That's the substance of what he's saying. But more than that, he's saying this, that there are times when the righteous suffer. And he's right in that. And there are times when the wicked prosper. And he was right in that. You see, that's something they never thought of. They never could understand that God would allow the righteous to suffer. But they had suffered, he knew that. And Job argued that, that at times, even the wrong seems to prosper. Now, you couldn't read your Bible without seeing, to your amazement, and mine too, how many evils have been committed, and the whole thing went well. It went well. Some of the most wicked schemes you can think about in your Bible, they were not only schemed and planned, but the whole thing was executed. And you say, how did that come about, or how did that work, how did that come about? Well, you see, there were wicked people getting away with what they'd aimed at. Then, quite often, many of the righteous had to suffer. You see, you will say, and you've all noticed it, I'm sure, that Jeremiah, in his day, near the end of the king's experience, the king's, because he was at the end of the times of the kings in Israel, that he picks up the language of Job and applies it to himself, and he is cursing his day, and he is wishing that he had never been born. So that there you have a man, Jeremiah, at the very end of the kingdom, as it were, and the sufferings were so great on his case that he just felt it was a pity I was ever born, that I was so downhearted that he just wished that, and he uses the very language almost word for word of Job, and so the commentators would be debating which wrote first and so on. I have no doubt at all it was Job that wrote it first, but that was in the book of Job before ever Jeremiah used it. But it just shows you now, and I hope you want to see that these things are not just a way vague and something that never would happen and never come your way. You see, it's hard to believe, brother. Now, don't be hard on me, and don't you be hard on thinking I'm being hard on you. It's hard to believe what you would say if you're in the right circumstances. It's just hard to believe. Well, you say, I would never. No, don't talk. Never talk about what you would never do, and what you would never say. It's amazing what some people have said, and what some people have thought, when certain circumstances brought them to conditions. We don't need to be too boastful now. We don't need to be thinking, though, I could never say those things. You see, we've never been in circumstances where they were squeezed out of us, as it were. And when Job has gone into this, now he says, I've been in the crucible. I'm like gold. I've been tried. But what we do want to learn now, and this is a bit I think we need to learn, and that is this. We would have thought, in our own minds, that all those billows and trials that had come the way of Job were all that he needed, as far as trial was concerned. But God saw to it that he had further trials, so that his three friends became the crucible, as it were, that heated it seven times hotter and made them feel all the more painful. In other words, they drove it home in a way that it really hurt him. Really hurt him. Oh, you say, that's tough. That's tough. I mean, your three friends, do you hear that? Friends, eh? Sometimes, you see, your friends can misunderstand. You know, I don't talk about relations. I'm not talking about relations. I don't think these men were at all related to Job. But friends that you have known for years, when you get into difficulties, they can become the most painful experience. I suppose life's made up with making friends and losing them. Maybe you don't lose any down here. I hope you don't. But you'll find that life's made up, mainly, with making friends and losing them. We lose many of them by being called home to glory. And some of us have greater friends on the other side than we have on this side. We're getting to that stage where most of those who were faithful to us and really friends of ours for most of our lifetime are now safe at home in glory. That's all right. We're thankful for every memory of them. But we have to be very careful that friends don't become, as it were, the very painful, distressing people that we never suspected they would be. Now, when Job saw those three friends coming to him, now listen carefully, dear saints of God. And he took a look, there's my old friend, I've seen him, I've known him for years, we have been talking together for a lifetime. And there's that other man, oh dear, I'm glad to see him. They don't come from the same part, but they're all gathering in around him. And there's that other man, I've known him, he's one of the best, one of the best. I'm glad to see him. Wouldn't he have naturally have thought that if anybody would have poured comfort into his soul, and anybody would have helped him at all, it would be those three friends that he had known for a lifetime. And yet they're the very ones that hurt him most. Hurt him most. I don't know how. We're slow scholars. Now, these are big things. Now, you mightn't think they're big, but you'll discover they're not so simple as they appear on the surface. We're slow scholars at discovering how little confidence we can put in mortal man. Now, I don't want us all to be going home and saying tonight, well, you could trust nobody. And you couldn't be a friend when you wouldn't know who's your friend or who's not. Now, don't be going home like that. That's not right. But I do believe God would ever teach us, whatever be the changing conditions in our life, that we don't rely on mortal flesh, no matter how kind and good it may be. God wants us to realize that He's the only one in whom we can put absolute confidence. Now, He does mean us to trust one another, and He does mean us to have confidence in one another, but never to lean on one another as if all as our dependence is wrapped up in Him. That would be the mistake we'd make. The late Mr. Allen used to say to us sometimes, he says, the people say, well, you know, so-and-so, he let me down. And maybe Mrs. So-and-so let me down, or Jimmy or Willie so-and-so let me down. And so see, the very fact that they say they let them down just showed that they were leaning on them. And I take it that as part of the program that God works, that He takes from us those very props that we would lean upon, and makes us conscious that we need His help, and we need Him alone. And that whoever else may forsake us, the living God will not forsake us. And we can still trust Him. Now you will notice that in the middle of all this, Job comes out with some very precious remarks. I not mentioned all of them tonight, but I will mention some of them. You say, well, if God was his friend, and he was, and if God was so good, and he was good, and if he be so righteous, and he was righteous, how came it that he allowed his servant to go into such deep distress? Well, I think we will gather this, that he was training him. He was training him. But I want us to learn this, that when all their arguments were going on, and they were saying, now a righteous God wouldn't deal with you like that. Now, Job, if you were righteous, you wouldn't get that suffering. You know what he says? So see, even he slays me, I'll still trust him. Even he slays me. Though he slay me, he says, I'll trust him. Now he'd gone very near. He'd gone very near slaying him, hadn't he? He had given him that dreadful disease of boils or whatever it is. We don't want to try and get at the medical end of it. It was something anyhow that he scraped, and it evidently was suppurating and was in an awful plight and suffering dreadful pain. And Job was conscious of this. Look, see, he's the living God. Instead of cursing him to his face, instead of renouncing God, no, he says, I'll trust him. I'll trust him. That's why we sing at times. I hope we do enjoy these simple things in our hymn book. Trusting as the moments fly, trusting as the days go by, till within the jasper wall, trusting Jesus, that is all. It's a great moment in a man's life, if I could call it a moment. It's a great achievement in a man's life, when he can rise above every friend on earth. Now think of it, dear soul. Now we're not making little of our friends. And rise above everything that's dear to him on earth. And rise to a height where he says, it's the Lord alone. When all around my soul gives way, he then is all my hope and stay. On Christ the solid rock I stand, all other ground is sinking sand. Yes, he says, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Ah, they're saying, look see, God grieved at you, man. And the devil was expecting you to crush him because of what had happened. That was what he thought he would do. Ah, says Job, I'll not curse God. No, nor I'll not renounce him, nor I'll not do anything, but I'll trust him. I'll trust him. And so Job is conscious, very conscious, that he is going to put his trust in God in spite of the difficulties that come his way. Now, that may bring us to a point. Now, would we be faithful about it? Do we trust God because of the good things he gives us? And because of the good he has done for us? Or do we trust him for who he is? Now, there's a difference there, isn't there? I wouldn't want us to underestimate what God has been to us. He's been kind. And we sing it at times, oh blessed God, how kind are all thy ways to me. And he has been good to us. But even we hadn't the favours and the blessings that are appreciated and valued by mortal man on earth, God is still God. And he's still the object of worship. And he's still to be trusted when he can't be traced. When he can't be traced. Now, Job, of course, now listen carefully, because we need to be careful when we're handling the Bible. If Job had seen the end of all his experience, I'll put it another way, had he known the background that we have in the first chapter of this book, he could have certainly been expected to put his trust in God. And he could have said to his friends, you know, just in a short time I'll be back where I used to be, and everything would be normal. You see, he didn't know that. Somebody as well said, you know, that if I had known as much, if Abraham had known as much as I know now that I've read the story, it wouldn't have cost him a thought to put Isaac on the altar. If he had seen the whole thing, there'd have been no trial in it. But it's because he didn't know that it was a real trial to put Isaac on the altar. And because Job didn't know what the end of the Lord, as James puts it. He didn't know the end of the Lord. He didn't know what God had in store for him. But he's still trusting God when he's not able to understand and not able to test. And that is bad. That is bad. You see, you never know what changes will come. Now, if the Lord would tarry, brother, be honest about it. Now, if the Lord tarries. And there are as many changes in the next 50 years as there's been in the last 50. Or we'll put it the last 100. And if the Lord would tarry for another 100 years, maybe the world could change bigly. And God's assemblies could change bigly. For some of them have changed a goodly bit already. And I think it's great to change. We might still have to realize that God doesn't change, and his word doesn't change, and that we have still God. We have still God, and that we can trust him as the moments fly. Again, I could go a wee bit closer now. We never know what's round the bend. We never know what trials will come our way. We never know what hospital ward we'll be in. We never know what difficulties will beset us. We're not trying to be pessimistic. We might live in sunshine to the end of days. We don't know. But you see, we can't just be sure that all circumstances will be unchanged. Right, great dear soul, when you can reach the stage in your thinking, now in your thinking, and in your mind, that you're prepared to trust God, irrespective of circumstances. In other words, Job never trusted God for what the benefits he received from him. Are you hearing that? But he trusted God because he knew him, as his God. Then we come to another line of things now. I'm not going to say much on this, but it's important. And we've already hinted at it in the meeting. Wasn't it a very solemn thing that when Job was in his hour of agony, that men were standing up, intensifying his wounds? Now, I would say that would be most humiliating for my mind to think about. That I could be given ministry that would only hurt people that are already hurt. Now, do you listen to that? Put men down that are already down. Put them down a bit further. And we should never do that. Now, these three men, they had sinned against God, and God admitted that God said that. And at the end of their speeches and their talk, they had to be a sacrifice offered by Job on their behalf. And he had to pray for them, because they had intensified his sorrow in the day of his deep snake. Please, dear saints of God, please be sensitive. When you're dealing with those in trouble, be sensitive. You say, what do you mean by that? Be careful that you're not insinuating that you're suffering because of certain things you did. And you're just reaping what you've sown. And if you just have lived the way you ought to have lived, everything would have been lovely today. Instead of that, you're in trouble. No wonder you're in trouble. You didn't do what was right, and there must be something wrong with you. Now that's putting in the dagger into the tender flesh of one who's already suffering. Now that's not right. That's not right, brother. Don't be hitting a man when he's down. Whatever you do. Never, never be guilty of that. And when people are distressed and grieved and sad, whatever you do, if you can't help them, don't hurt them. I would say that with all my heart. Again, another matter Job raises with these men, and we'll have to close. But it was this. He says, look, you men don't know what I'm suffering. You don't know what I'm passing through. In other words, when they were preaching at him, and instructing him, and telling him, now there you are, and you used to help others, and you were a man that gave other people counsel, and now you're in the trouble yourself, and you're no goose in it, you're fainting under it, and so on. They were cutting it in on them very tight. You know what Job had to tell them? Look, boys, you never were here yourselves. If you'd have been here yourselves, you'd be different men. They had never been through the mill. Now, you know, I'm using homely terms. Bear with me. I try to speak in a way that people can understand. They had never passed that way. And you see, that was why they weren't able to minister to him in those conditions. I'll put it another way around, and you'll get a hold of it right away. Supposing in the 100 years or so that Job lived after this, he had met some God-fearing man who had come to adversity and passed through deepest trials and grief and sorrow in his heart and life. And Job could have sat down beside him. Are you listening to me? Job could have sat down beside him and says, now, son, brother, I'm telling you something. I've been here. I've been here. And he could have strengthened him. Because he had already had experience in that very faith. The trouble with many, dear brethren, and we don't want to be critics, and there are enough of them alive without me adding to their number. But the trouble with them is this, quite often they're ministering on subjects, and they have never been through the experience themselves. Now, I judge it was an education for Job. It made him an unusual man on the face of the earth. But isn't it great for us now? And we should appreciate this, that we now have the record of it. And so we can be preserved from doing what those three friends were doing. And then we can, in some measure, adopt a kindly attitude toward those in the crucible, so that we don't add to their pain, but comfort them and encourage them with the thought of God's great grace that can come and will come in his own appointed time. May the Lord help us learn these lessons. They're big and weighty, mighty in this world. We can't be in the world without, in some measure, facing trials that we never expected and certainly don't want. Remember that. And don't want. None of us want trial. And none of us want these difficulties. And we can't be in this world without, in some measure, encountering it. And in some way or other, finding the storm coming our way. Now the Lord that looked after Job and blessed the latter end of Job more than the beginning is the same God as we have. May we learn to trust him with all our hearts. Shall we pray? Not for singing much. 254. My soul amid this stormy world is like some fluttered dove, and fain would be a swift of wing to flee to him I love. We sing the first two verses of 254. Shall we stand while singing, please?